Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
I'm working on a blog in the post-International Conference of Secular AA that just two or three podcasts ago, Alan and I were at together. Many of the fellow travelers experienced, you know, an emotional high from the conference and then boom, a crash. So I'm writing a blog about that. And one of the things that impacted my downer afterwards was, I mean, I was in the middle of Helene or affected by it. I was in Savannah, Georgia. And on the 28th, just days after, we got the news, like while we had no power and I had very poor bandwidth, that Kris Kristofferson died. And he was a huge influence on me. He had a 1971 record, The Silver Tongue Devil and I. And so I'm incorporating some of his lyrics into the blog to pay homage. And I put the challenge out that, at least in my record collection, that is the greatest year in music. And there are plenty of years tied for second place with me, but that one had...
What year is that again, Joe?
1971. T-Rex, Electric Warrior, Sticky Fingers, The Rolling Stones, Marvin Gaye, Wilson Pickett, Carole King's Tapestry came from that, American Pie, America's First Album, Led Zeppelin IV, Jethro Tull, Deep Purple's Fireball. You know, that's just a little bit, right? Like there was great rock, there was great singer-songwriter stuff, there was great R&B, a lot of stuff coming out of Motown. It was the most amazing year, really influential for this young addict alcoholic. You would have been in early sobriety then, Alan.
Quite a year, 71, that's my year of sobriety.
Kris Kristofferson, that's the archetype of the compassionate badass. My favorite archetype, actually.
Yeah, and one of the things, in a moment, we'll talk a little bit about 30 Things, Practical Advice for Living Well, the new Bill Schaeberg book. But Kris Kristofferson, Bill Schaeberg also, the ability to economize words, to say so much with so little, like Sunday morning coming down, right? It just, every sentence, it would take me an hour to say what he says. It's amazing. So, Chris, I miss you.
How about you, Tom?
I'm doing good, and I have been grieving Kristofferson, and along with so many others. I mean, you know, they're, as a friend of mine says, we should take cover. They're picking us off one by one.
My dear friend, Dr. Rader, may he rest in peace, said it's that number in the deli line keeps getting closer and closer and closer. Number 69, number 68. And I'm sitting there holding like, what, 55 or something like that. It's like, uh-oh, I'm going to get called soon.
Yeah, yeah. Like you start seeing people dying who are younger than you and you go,
God. Isn't that a trip, man? That's a real trip. That is. And yet,
it's really bad when somebody younger than you dies and your first thought is that old guy died.
I remember when, what were people crying about people dying at 27? That was a nice long life, right? You know, you didn't want to get to 30 where you couldn't.
Oh, yeah. All those guys, Morrison and Joplin, they all died at 27. Yeah.
In and around 1971, too.
And they were too cool too early. They needed to wait, kind of let their coolness stretch its legs a little bit. A
lot of coolness there.
Well, we've got some reading here, and we're going to have Joe start us off. But could you give us a little intro of this book and some primer for our listeners about what we're about to read, Joe?
Okay, we'll call him Bill Schaeberg. William H. Schaeberg is well known to the recovery community for his book, Writing the Big Book, The Creation of AA, which was 11 years of primary documentary research about the early days of AA, which blew away a lot of myths, but still preserved the integrity of the story of early AA. But a lot of the stories I'd heard and repeated don't stand up to documentary research. It's not quite how it happened in our sort of bedtime story version of early AA. So it has been an eye-opener for a lot of people. But you take away the myths and the sort of side of it, and the beauty and power and miracle, if you don't have a better word for it, of AA coming together as part of the new thought movement is still alive and well, even when you do all your fault finding, like there's a reward for
even,
it.
Even with scrutiny, you can look really close and it's still there. That's great. Yeah,
that's right. And so this book is something very different. He's also done deep dives on other classic literature, on the work of Nietzsche, for instance. But this one is a legacy book. It's his own path. It's called 30 Things, Practical Advice for Living Well. If people would ask him through the last sort of 40 years, hey, Bill, do you sponsor guys? He would say, well, in these rooms, I've learned 30 things. I'll tell them to you. How's that? And so he thought, you know, he really wanted to write a book that, you know, his children or grandchildren could enjoy, you know, and he's 81 now and, you know, thinking about a legacy. So we talked about this and we've been trying to find excuses to work together. As Alan, you and I have, ICSA was a lot of fun, and we've done a couple of those on the same billing. And Bill and I want to do this. So Rebellion Dogs Publishing published this book, and it came out in August. And we had a Zoom book launch. And Dr. Joe Nowinski, who some of you would know as the author of 12-Step Facilitation, he sort of wrote the manual on that. He was asked to review the book and he thought, oh, no, not another book on advice, you know, please. But he found it a very humble, personal, vulnerable experience sharing. And a lot of other people who'd already read it spoke to it. But Mary C. from Savannah, she said, it's a love story. Mm-hmm. It's just this story of his sobriety and his, in many cases, his beloved, the Lady Sarah comes into play. And she saw it as a beautiful tribute, you know, a very vulnerable and beautiful tribute. And of course, we're all thinking of its technical capacity, but she just sort of, you know, knocked us all off our feet.
Found the essence.
Yeah, that's right, for sure. So we were looking for something to read today, and I thought we'd introduce listeners to this book. Some of them, I'm sure, have already picked it up, but it's 30 chapters. We're going to read from chapter 7. And I'll kick it off a little bit. And the chapter is called Never Say You Shouldn't Feel That Way. And just one more intro bit. It fits in so well, not only with emotional sobriety, but with what Alan was talking about and what everybody here is sort of working on now, emotional sobriety in our relationships with others. So never say you shouldn't feel that way. And here we are again, back with my friend, the amazing therapist, Larry. That was Larry Schneider. While Sarah and I were in couples counseling with him, I was once, just once, Bill, upset by something she said, and I responded by telling her she had no right to feel that way. I said it was a completely inappropriate reaction. Larry's response was something to behold. He interrupted forcefully and told me in no uncertain terms that it was my reaction that was inappropriate and completely out of line. He said, I should never criticize Sarah by telling her she, quote, shouldn't feel that way, close quotes. People feel the way they feel, he said. It's their own emotional reality, and you can't just blindly dismiss another person's reality like that. It may make no sense to you, but that is, in fact, the way she feels. And people are entitled to their feelings, whatever they may be. Feelings have a primal validity that cannot be denied. They are what they are. So please, don't ever say anything like that to Sarah again. I must admit, I had struggled with this. From my own perspective, obviously so much more accurate, her response was completely unsatisfactory for the circumstances of that situation, and I was therefore well within my rights to call her out and demand she adopt a more appropriate emotional response to the matter. But over time, I come to so many of these things very slowly. I had to realize two things. One, my own argumentative perspective was self-centered and, more important, self-serving in the extreme. And two, Larry's observation of human emotions didn't just apply to the Lady Sarah. It was equally valid in relation to everyone else I had to deal with in my life. However reluctantly, I finally had to concede that that was right. Feelings are feelings. They are what they are. And you can never tell anyone you shouldn't feel that way, if that's the way they feel.
For me to allow Sarah to have her feelings without argument, or equally important, without me trying to fix the way she felt, proved to be one of the more important tools Larry ever gave me. His gifts were many, but this one was easily in the top three. In the beginning, realizing the trouble that resulted whenever I told Sarah she shouldn't feel that way was enough to convince me that I wanted to make every effort to avoid falling into that particular trap again. It didn't take tremendous amounts of honest recollection and reflection to see that this particular approach had never really turned out well. However, over time, as I studiously refrained from using the forbidden phrase, my silence gradually pushed me in the direction of a completely different response. Rather than judging her reaction by my own, I began trying to understand what it must be like for her to feel that way and why, and to react with some empathy. Unexpectedly, each step away from judgment took me one step closer to compassion. It literally made Sarah more interesting to me, and this had the blessed effect of increasing the intimacy of our relationship. She became more and more real to me and less of a product of my self-centered male delusions. Increasingly convinced of the rightness of Larry's comments, I have frequently been able to expand this compassionate approach to include friends, relatives, and even coworkers. Acknowledging the undeniable reality of other people's feelings and accepting them on their own terms, really, really accepting them for what they are, has had a profound and positive effect on so many of my relationships. Please don't mistake me. At times, I have found this to be a very difficult in the extreme.
For instance, one of my best friends has struggled with clinical depression his whole life, and I have never been able to understand his worldview or his consistently dark reactions to everyday life. As far as I can see, his circumstance just don't warrant that kind of a response. He's a great guy, bright, witty, and engaging, a truly accomplished professional. So he should be happy, right? Well, in short, he just shouldn't feel that way. But that dark world is his reality. However unjustified from my perspective, his world is not my world, and I must accept that. I have no special powers that would magically allow him to see the world from my perspective. All I can do is acknowledge and accept his reality. It is the only way we could ever have continued to be such good friends for the past three decades.
This one change in my perspective on other people's perspectives was significant and far-reaching. Other people became more individuated and real, and because of that, I found I could relate to them more readily and more deeply. Larry's advice has helped me to lay aside my knee-jerk judgments, at least some of the time. And whenever I'm able to do that, the world invariably becomes wider, broader, and far more interesting. And what's not to like about that? I feel, Joe, when I read this, there's something about his energy that's like being transmitted through the words.
Well, yeah, it's a nice little snapshot of an important moment, you know, obviously in Bill's life, but in a lot of people's lives. But, you know, there's so much to unpack here. You mind if I jump in, or do you want to say something?
Go for it.
Joe,
take it away, Alan.
So, you know, this comes down to, you know, communication, obviously, in terms of what's being communicated. So I wish in one way that Bill would have shared with us what he said you shouldn't feel that way about. We don't know what the specific thing was, because here's where I want to get into a little bit here. A lot of people think that they're talking about their feelings when they're really talking about conclusions. If I say something like, I feel that you're angry with me, that's not a feeling. It's a conclusion I drew from your behavior. And a lot of times thoughts and feelings get very, very mixed up. Mainly from the person who's, for me, if I'm communicating my reaction, sometimes I don't differentiate between what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking. You know, like for me, if I say I feel that, see, that's a clue. If I say I feel that, I'm talking about a conclusion. If I say I'm angry, I don't say I feel that I'm angry. I say I'm angry. I'm sad. I'm upset. Right? Those kinds of things. So there's an interesting thing here that we didn't get a chance to really tease out in this chapter. Now, that's me being a therapist and putting on my therapeutic cap for a minute. But let's just say that she said, I'm sad about something. And he said, you shouldn't be sad. All right, let's say that that was the interaction. We don't know if that was the case, but let's just go ahead and assume for a minute that she said something, Sarah said something like that. I'm upset with you, or I'm sad. You shouldn't feel that way, right? That's inappropriate. See, that's where, you know, he's right on, is that I don't have any business telling anybody what they should or shouldn't feel. See, this is where should demands come into our relationships. And it's the result of a much bigger problem. I mean, he put his finger on it, but it was like he was warm. He didn't totally hit the target. See, he said, I was self-centered. Yes, he was. He was making it all about him. But even more so is that his development was delayed. He was still demanding that Sarah functioned a certain way so that he would be okay. See, what we saw was it wasn't just self-centeredness, it was emotional dependency. And see, that's what a lot of people have not connected, Joe, in this whole work that we're talking about, is the self-centeredness is related to the emotional dependency. If I wasn't so dependent, like he said, once he let that go, he could actually see Sarah. And that's what my dear friend Dr. Kempler said, is once we stop taking things so personally, we can be more personal. He had more compassion for her. He had more empathy, et cetera, et cetera. The minute I take what the other person's doing personally, there can be no empathy, because I'm making it all about me. And that part, I really saw exactly what he was talking about. Now, the other thing that's so important here is that what we talk about all the time is that when you're upset, right? You know, Bill said it very clearly. It's a spiritual axiom that every time we're upset, there's something wrong with us. You know, I've modified that to say something off with us, because I don't like shaming us. But what's off is that we have this expectation and this demand on how people should behave for us to be okay. And see, it's very important for me to understand the connection to this bigger issue about I'm okay if consciousness. That's what Bill was really referring to. I'm okay if Sarah talks to me in the way I want Sarah to talk to me, and I don't know what to do if she doesn't. So what I'm going to do is tell her she shouldn't do it so that I try to control her, manipulate her to get to talk to me the way I want her to. Anyway, it's great. I mean, I love that moment where he's challenged and that he looks at it. And I think it was a powerful intervention for him. And I think it's important for us to put it in a larger perspective when we talk about emotional sobriety.
You know, there's this constant dynamic in a relationship of how much autonomy am I going to have? And you know, how much reliance am I going to have?
First thing is that every relationship is about, there's going to be some kind of a dialogue, some kind of negotiation on how we're going to meet the needs of each of the individuals in the relationship. And so that's a given. That's what a relationship is about. Mm-hmm. Another part of it is that there's going to be two issues that are going to show up in every relationship. The amount of togetherness one person wants and the amount of separateness. See, that togetherness and separateness become a very important dynamic in every relationship. I may want togetherness while my partner may want to be separate for a period of time. Well, how do we negotiate that? How do we deal with that difference between us? Now, if I'm emotionally immature and dependent on them, I will make them wrong when they want something different than what I want. You never want to spend time with me. See, that's the way. Now, is that expressing my feelings? No, that's complaining. So let's get clear. Complaining is not expressing your feelings. If I said to my partner something like, I miss you and I really would like to spend more time with you.
I love that you always advise that. That's, yeah.
I mean, now I'm owning what I want and asking for what I want in a way that at least gives me a better chance of getting my needs met. But if I make you wrong to get my needs met, think about that. How is that an effective way of trying to communicate my desire to you? That doesn't inspire. You know, what that does is it pushes you away. It alienates you from me. And see, this is where in this whole quest for emotional sobriety, you know, we talk so much about taking responsibility for our own needs and desires, and that no one is here on earth to meet my needs and satisfy them. They may choose to do that in a relationship with me, but if I demand that, man, I'm creating a lot of trouble in my relationships. And unfortunately, this is what happens, man. Most relationships turn into a power struggle. And that's what I would say was going on with Bill and her and Sarah. I would say Bill was trying to get her to do things the way he wanted her to do it. And he was going to tell her she was inappropriate as his way of trying to manipulate her. Now, that, you know, thank God Larry jumped in and said, sorry, that's not going to work here, you know, and kind of poisoned that well, which we need that well to get poisoned, because it forced Bill to develop another possibility in the relationship, which he eventually said led him to more compassion. I would say that compassion was bred out of his empathy for her, and that he started to see Sarah and how Sarah was trying to get her needs met rather than seeing Sarah is not meeting his needs.
When you were, when we were doing the reading, and then especially Alan, when you referred it back to not just self-centeredness, but emotional dependency, I got this mental image of there's the battery source between people, you know, the person criticizing the one with the feelings that he insists are wrong, and you know, moving that battery source from that other person to within yourself, and the kind of way that you know, leeches the desperation and the tension and the kind of enmity out of the interaction. And I guess like a little personal anecdote that may be somewhat relevant is that there's a client and a friend that I have who's kind of on the newer side. And he sat down with me recently with like another friend, and for whatever reason, really wanted to get into talking about politics, even though we'd never discussed some of these controversial topics before. And he's like, well, let's sit down and let's talk about Israel-Palestine for a little bit. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to jam about how I feel about all of it. And, you know, I felt cliff incoming, you know, I'm about to drop off the cliff and everything's going to go terribly wrong. But instead of imposing my viewpoint on this discussion that he was insisting upon, I listened to him, and I made the mandate of the interaction, not that I was going to express, I didn't even really want to express my point of view, because like, that's not what I was coming to the conversation armed with. I like this guy, and our positions couldn't be more night and day different from each other, but I just wanted to be with him and hear him out. And it was more about, I guess this is where we're talking about thoughts and feelings. Like I just wanted to be with this guy, you know, no matter what he said. And I said very little of, you know, my contrary opinion about it all. And we had a nice conversation and then moved on and talked about other things. But I got compliments, oddly, later on from both this guy. He sent me a text later, and my other friend. And this is hilarious to me, just because you guys all know me. Like, wow, it was so wonderful how you navigated that conversation without excluding his point of view. And, you know, we should do that again sometime. And I'm like, wait, is this me you're talking to? Like, this is a very bizarre thing for somebody to be saying to me. You know, I don't think anybody ever changed the other person's mind without first just being with them. And not trying to kind of and being with them and kind of showing some empathy for their feelings, and, you know, not just trying to impose and crush ourselves onto, you know, whatever it is that they're trying to express.
If our defenses are sky high, we're not gonna hear anything. We're just gonna reinforce whatever we have. Now, one of the things I want to say is everybody in the group will get this. Is, you know, metaphors are great. I love metaphors. I'm going to have to go to Metaphors Anonymous, but I refuse to go. But it's whenever Patrick uses a metaphor, he's about to fall off a cliff, I pay attention, because he knows exactly what that feels like. That must be very serious. It's like, man, you've experienced it without metaphor. I mean, that's when you said, that's the first thing I thought. I just saw you plummeting. And I thought, man, I don't know if I was conscious or not conscious, but it's like that's makes it even everything you did a bigger deal to me. I mean, you really did great. And don't be so surprised that you did. I mean, you know, it's like, I do know you, but it's like, I've also had many conversations with you, and you can be opinionated about stuff. I can be opinionated about stuff, but you know, you're also a good listener. So it's credit where credit is due is usually my mantra for you, Patrick. And I'm glad you got a chance to experience that yourself, but not surprising. And the only thing I want to add to the bigger conversation here is let's expand what Larry's saying. We can get into all the nuance about this stuff, but it's not just in talking about what Alan, you're saying about the thoughts too. I've been in a lot of couples therapy. We also don't get to tell people how to think either. So it's like, if we tell somebody, because boy, I spent a lot of time in two different marriages trying to educate the woman how to think. And if she would just think the way I would think, then she would feel better. According to Mary Elizabeth Hickman, my Larry. Nope, that's not going to work.
That could be a Kris Kristofferson song.
Started writing a song about Mary Elizabeth Hickman's.
Is that on the mark? I mean, my anecdote, does that kind of fit into what we're talking about a little bit?
You know, I'm smiling over here, Patrick, because I remember a couple of years ago, you know, that you're very strong in your political beliefs and stuff like that. And I'm quite aware at times that you used to communicate those beliefs in a way that really polarized you from people. And there wasn't a lot of room for other people. And you are maturing, man, you know, and I hear it, because if you can see one of the hallmarks of emotional sobriety is that we create room for two people in a relationship instead of room for the rules. When we are emotionally dependent and undifferentiated, we live with a tremendous amount of rules on how things are supposed to be, how things should be, and we impose them on ourselves and others readily. Mm-hmm. With very little awareness of how intrusive we're being, how demanding we're being, and how immature we're being. I mean, my God, I can't tell you how many people, including myself, when I woke up to this, I realized, my goodness gracious me, you know, look at how I've been functioning in these relationships that I've been having. I can't believe anybody stayed with me as long as they did. I mean, and this kind of, you know, when I really got clear on what the heck was going on. So, yes, not only, you know, did what you say was right on, but it really shows your growth through these years and the work you've been doing in your recovery, Patrick.
Thank you. And thank you, Tom, as well, for the nice things you said. And I do not want to be polarized from people. I don't want to let go of certain values. I don't want my values to become diluted, I suppose. But maybe there's a way for them to not be diluted, but for me to not be polarized from others that I care about. I think that's what I'm after. That's
a good, this is a little off subject, but it's relevant to just communication. What you said about that, I don't want to be misunderstood as agreeing. And I think sometimes we in the whole area of disrespectful communication that we have in our culture, period, whether we were arguing or not, is that what we have a fear that remaining silent about something is going will be interpreted as agreement, and really what we need to be sure we're doing, practicing ourselves, is if you haven't said anything in this conversation, then I, rather than walk out of the room and be able to say, well, I'm pretty sure that Joe was thinking da 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 da, yeah, I need to go like, I don't, you know, I could make up some stuff I think Joe was thinking, but I have no idea because Joe didn't speak.
That's
a lot to have that kind of respect, you know, and it's respect for yourself and respect for the other person. Is I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between, you know, being naturally endowed with a healthy attachment style, where I expect my partner to have needs that they will express to me, and I'm grateful to help meet them. And I also expect that I can express my needs to my partner. And why wouldn't they want to participate and negotiate and discuss, you know, how they can help meet them versus, you know, an unhealthy attachment style, you know, often characterized as either anxious or avoidant. But there, you know, this unmet need often coming from early childhood, you know, I bring that to my relationship. And, you know, I have rules instead of space, right? And I'm not going to, you said this so great at the conference. Of course, I'm not going to tell them these rules. You know, I'm going to sneak them in one at a time later on once I got the hooks in them, right? And
I'll let you know when you break them, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like bowling in the dark. No one knows how they're doing. But like being capable of empathy with a partner, and not to say that a life of solitude or individualism isn't awful, but this book that Bill wrote, another of his chapters is loving someone means acting as if their happiness is important to you and pay attention to what you pay attention to. He's really paying homage to all of the people who influenced him in his life about how, you know, this idea of rugged individualism he had to let go of, and reaching out for help and trying to see things the way other people see things, and to sort of expand his capacity. It requires a certain amount of self-esteem. And another writer I know, Andy C., who's a lawyer and a member of the International Lawyers in AA, I think he's sort of managing that this year. It might have been last year. The years fly by. I don't know. But he wrote once that self-esteem doesn't require an audience, while ego wants a loud and enthusiastic crowd. And, you know, sometimes, you know, self-esteem and ego, you know, that's a great way to sort of differentiate the two, where I'm, you know, it's self-sustaining, my self-esteem. My ego needs constant reinforcement. And someone thinking a way that is uncomfortable to me or feeling a way that doesn't fit with my agenda, that's going to be a threat to my ego, but it wouldn't be a threat to my self-esteem.
Right.
I have a high opinion of the guy I was talking to that evening. I do not have a high opinion of some of the things he was expressing, but he reminds me a little bit of you guys. Like, he's very empathetic and, you know, and very like thoughtful, and he's very
good looking.
Not as good looking. No, he's on the lower end of the scale, but I've noticed that, that when we're in a group and, you know, he's very like validating of like the positively reinforcing of things other people in the group are doing in a way that like is unusual, I think, for men. And I appreciate that, you know, so I try to like, it's these types of things that I try to bring into like stickier subjects. And maybe look at like the fullness of somebody's identity. You know, it doesn't. There's a lot to it.
And,
right?
And Patrick, what you're doing there, I mean, God, that's as good a description as there is of somebody who approaches relationships and approaches your life with a mentality of non-polarization. It's like, because polarization. If I had to list maybe top three or something like that, problems that human beings have, that if we could actually resolve them, that we would be so much better. Polarization is one of them. It's not just politics. We're so simple minded, you know, that we just, so Alan does something that I don't like. And all, so it's like, and I get it. This is different for individuals, but I grew up in a family where basically that means Alan's not good. I don't like Alan. You know, and I may like him later, but I don't like him right now. But for you to say that, just take a minute and just acknowledge a lot of people, maybe most people we know, don't think like that. Don't say, there's a guy I disagree with a lot. I really respect him. I really like him. And then you compliment him about some of the stuff that he does that you really appreciate. You know, that's not a statement of he's doing that right and he has the wrong opinion about the politics. You're just saying the things that you appreciate about him. And it's wide open minded. So.
Well, I'm sure you can all attest it takes a while to get here and there's a lot further to go. And it's worth the undertaking. But man, it takes a long time.
Yeah. Well, we have to expand what, you know, going back to this, Larry and the therapist, I was, you know, I'm comparing Larry with Mary Elizabeth. And one of the things about, I tell this story pretty often, you probably heard it, but it's like, well, she had us listing things, you know, what are some things your spouse could do that say, I love you. And Dee Dee got to the top of her list and it was change the cat litter. And I immediately said, I said, that's not love. And this is where you'll know that I had the right therapist. Because just as quickly, Mary Elizabeth said, well, it is now.
That's good.
And it's like, you know, that's that thing where you give people what you want to get, but you don't listen to what they want, you know. And it's like, you know, so when I change that cat litter, I am loving my wife. I'm not loving the cats, by the way, at that point. I'm just loving my wife.
Well, just to remind everybody again, just before we wrap today, is that emotional sobriety is when you act for yourself without being selfish.
Yeah.
Yep.
When you act for others without being selfless. That's Tom's example. people there. He was not doing that because he was sacrificing himself over the cat litter for his wife. He did that as an expression of his love for his wife. That's why he was showing that. And we got to keep in mind that we can include ourselves into the picture. We just cannot, you know, exclude the other person. See, that's the issue. We want to be inclusive, not exclusive. Let's do another one of these chapters. I like this is a great way to.
Sure. I could send Bill if you wanted to. Yeah.
You better accompany him, Joe.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah, we can definitely do that. You know, what I have to watch out for, Tom, you talked about taking silence as agreement. And I was in a relationship where that was the case because freeze and fawn were my most likely responses to, you know, being triggered, right? And whenever I just froze and didn't respond, she thought, well, that's just my male pride. I obviously agree. And, you know, and it meant, you know, I don't feel safe. That's what it meant.
I don't suppose there's any projects you guys want me to put in the show notes or anything like that, aside from the book, of course.
No, just send me some money. Anybody wants to send me some money, they can get my address on the website. And just,
how about buy your books?
Yeah, just go. Oh, yeah, you can do it that way, too. Okay, good.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.